Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The estimate that 1 in 68 children is diagnosed on the autism spectrum is about 30% higher than the estimate for 2008 and roughly 60% higher than 2006. To some, the increase in diagnosis represents an epidemic. Others believe that autism has always been with us. We just didn't know what to call it. Today, we're talking about the implications of our growing awareness of the risk factors and the idea of the spectrum, where it begins and how far it reaches. Coming up later in the program, we'll hear from the director of the Center for Autism Spectrum Disorders at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Joining us now by phone is the author of the new book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity, Steve Silberman. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Hi, Ann. It's wonderful to be here.
So who discovered autism? Where does the story sort of begin in academia, if you will?
Yeah, well, that actually turns out to be a fascinating question, because the widely accepted history of autism says that it was discovered by a child psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore named Leo Kanner. And in 1943, Leo Kanner published a landmark paper describing 11 of his young patients. The descriptions are very, very beautiful and probing. So he ended up becoming the world's leading authority on autism for decades, actually. So he defined the scope of the diagnosis, eventually defined the criteria for diagnosis, et cetera. And in fact, his office was described as the national clearinghouse for autism diagnoses by one of his colleagues. So Leo Kanner really owned the autism diagnosis for most of the 20th century. And as we'll see, that ended up having numerous effects. What I discovered, however, is that that story is not quite right. It turns out that in the 1930s, a clinician in Austria, working at the University of Vienna Hospital, named Hans Asperger, who had a very, very interesting clinic. It was incredibly progressive for its time in that it was sort of half a clinic and half a residential school. And the staff really lived with the children intimately and observed them, quote-unquote, down to their very toes, as one of Asperger's assistants mentioned. And what Asperger discovered is really what we now call the autism spectrum. So Asperger didn't just discover autism. He had this extremely prescient view that autism was a lifelong condition that lasts from birth to death, and that requires very special forms of support from the family, from teachers, and from the community. And he actually worked with the children in his clinic to develop methods of education that would be appropriate for them. And he affectionately called them his little professors, in part for that reason, because he saw them as little authorities on their own condition, in a sense. So Asperger's discovery was amazing. But what no one knew until my book came out is that the two discoveries of autism by Asperger and Kanner have long been considered one of the great sort of mysterious synchronicities of the 20th century, of 20th century medicine, really. This amazing coincidence that, you know, two clinicians and on two different continents discovered autism within a year of each other. And Asperger's paper, which was published in 1944, is usually sort of consigned to a footnote to Kanner's landmark discovery. Mm-hmm. However, what I learned by doing 5 years of research was that Kanner had actually hired Asperger's chief diagnostician, George Frankl, and rescued him from the Holocaust. Because remember, in the late 1930s in Austria, the Nazis marched in, declared that Austria was part of the great German fatherland, and became part of the Third Reich. And so Jews, like George Frankl, had to leave. And so Kanner did this truly heroic thing and rescued hundreds of Jewish clinicians before they were put to death during the Holocaust. And in fact, Kanner not only had George Frankl at his side, he had Annie Weiss, who became Annie Weiss Frankl when she moved here because she married her old colleague George. And so Kanner actually had two of Asperger's best minds, really, in his circle when he, quote-unquote, discovered autism. And even more crucially, it was Frankl who evaluated Connor's first three autistic patients. So it turns out not to be, you know, such a huge synchronicity after all. It turns out to be George Frankl was the, you know, a very direct connection between the two researchers.
What happened? But with, okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was going to say, this the fact that Connor became famous while Asperger didn't ended up having a big effect because Connor's conception of autism was much more narrow. It was definitely limited to children. He didn't even consider the notion that teenagers and adults could be autistic until much later in his career, and we're talking decades. Hmm. But also, Connor was very, very strict and parsimonious about dispensing his diagnosis. He once bragged that he turned 9 out of 10 children referred to his office for a diagnosis of autism by other clinicians away without giving them one, because he was very afraid that his diagnosis, which was often referred to as Connor's syndrome rather than autism, would be watered down. So we ended up with an extremely narrow, and in fact artificially narrow and restricted, definition. And Connor never mentioned Asperger once in his voluminous writing about autism. He did mention his name once in the 1970s, so decades had gone by, in a very dismissive book review, and he said, oh yes, Asperger. What that person discovered was, at best, a 42nd cousin of my syndrome. So the reason why, you know, Asperger's name eventually became familiar because it was attached to this diagnosis of Asperger syndrome, which was in part invented to cover some of the people who had been left out of Connor's conception. But yeah, anyway, the conditions under which autism was discovered by these two clinicians ended up having cascading effects through the decades.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the history of the diagnosis of autism. My guest is Steve Silberman. He is the author of a new book. It's called Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. I want to jump way ahead in a way, because I want to get to this before we move on and talk about the title of your book, Neurotribes. What do you mean by that?
What do I mean by that? It's a word I invented, so it's not, you know, it's not like you should know where it comes from. It came from me sitting here at my desk. But what I mean by that is that the original idea came from a notion of this guy Erwin Lazar, who was the founder of Hans Asperger's clinic. And what Erwin Lazar believed was that the children in the clinic were divided, in a sense, into tribes of people who had various aptitudes. And he saw the job of the people who worked in the clinic to determine which tribe the children belonged to so that an appropriate course of education could be offered to them. Because remember, it was not just a clinic where kids, you know, were brought for a couple of hours to get a diagnosis. They would actually live there for weeks. And in fact, one of the sort of historical scoops in my book is that I actually go into the daily life of the clinic quite in depth, which is something that no one has ever done before. And so anyway, Erwin Lazar believed that humanity, in a sense, was organized into tribes or teams, and that if you could, if you could figure out, or if a clinician could figure out which tribe you belong to, then the clinician could make good recommendations about, you know, what jobs you might be suited for, what problems in daily life you might have. And so that seemed to me to be a more promising way to frame the changing views of autism than just a list of, you know, in a sense, mental disorders or something. So I tried to humanize autism by using that word.
Where did the term autism come from?
Well, it came from I believe he was a Swiss psychologist or psychiatrist named Eugen Bleuler. And both Asperger and Connor would have read Eugen Bleuler because he was one of the first authorities on schizophrenia. In fact, he might have even coined the word schizophrenia, which means splitting of the mind. But it originally meant someone who is so wrapped up in their own fantasies that they gradually withdrew from the social world. But it's not an ideal term. It wasn't an ideal term to describe this new condition or this, you know, newly coined condition, because autistic people are not wrapped up in their own fantasies or something like that. In fact, they tend to have very literal minds and may even, you know, fantasize less than non-autistic people. But anyway, so that's where it comes from. It was in the air in psychology when Connor and Asperger made their discoveries.
The British author and neurologist Oliver Sacks wrote the foreword for your book, and he said that he knew of no one else who had spent so much time trying to understand what it is like to be autistic. Why did you embark on this work in the first place, Steve Silberman?
Well, I mean, do you want me to tell the two-minute story of how I got interested in autism? Or
This is a big fat book. It's in the fat book category. I can't wait to read the entire thing, but it's a lot of work you put into this.
You're telling me.
Yeah.
No, I know.
A clinician. You're not. That's not your background, right?
Oh, that's true. Uh-huh. I'm not a clinician. And then the other, you know, sort of most frequently asked question is, do I have an autistic son or daughter? And no, I don't. Mm-hmm. So I approach this from the perspective of a science journalist, because I've been a science journalist writing for many different magazines, including Wired, for a couple of decades now. So I'm coming to it from a science journalist perspective. And in part, I believe, you know, it was the skills that I developed doing that that helped me dig under the widely accepted view of autism history and find the documents that prove that there was this living connection between Connor and Asperger. But the short version of the story is, I was on a boat in Alaska in, I believe it was 2000, with more than 100 computer programmers. And the star of the cruise was a guy who invented one of the first open source programming languages called Perl. And towards the end of the cruise, I asked him if I could come to visit him at his home in Silicon Valley. And he said, yeah, sure, I should tell you, we have an autistic daughter. And because I didn't know that much about autism, like most people at that time, I believed it was rare. I thought, you know, perhaps I would never run into an autistic person. I had seen Rain Man, of course, almost everyone did, but I didn't know that much more about autism. Anyway, so, you know, I registered his remark, but didn't think much of it. Then a few months later, I was writing about another technologically adept family in Silicon Valley. I asked the sister-in-law of the woman I was writing about if I could come and visit her at home. And she said, yeah, sure. By the way, we have an autistic daughter. And so I thought, wow, that's kind of odd, you know? And so I was telling a friend of mine that story in my neighborhood cafe here in San Francisco when a young woman at the next table blurted out, oh, my God. Do you realize what's happening? And I said, what's happening? And she said, I'm a special education teacher in Silicon Valley. There's an epidemic of autism in Silicon Valley. Something terrible is happening to our children. And so I got a chill, you know, and when a, you know, science reporter gets a chill, they also get the urge to, you know, start working and start doing research and figuring out if it was true. So I wrote an article for Wired called The Geek Syndrome in 2001 about autism in high-tech communities. And it was very well received, but as time went on, I started to feel like I had missed the larger story, because the letters that I was getting, both from the families I had written about and from autistic people themselves in email, were not so occupied with what causes autism, which is, of course, you know, has been a national obsession since vaccines came into question, you know, more than a decade ago. We're obsessed with determining the risk factors and the causes of autism. But that's not what most families were writing to me about. They were writing to me about the fact that when their children would graduate high school, they would so-called age out of services, and really the family would be left twisting in the wind with very little support and resources. And so I started to feel that the national obsession with determining the cause of autism, because after all, we've been looking for the cause of schizophrenia for, you know, 50 years and haven't found it yet. I mean, we found genetic factors and, you know, possible environmental factors, and the same kind of arc is playing out with autism. But I felt like, you know, maybe we're not actually really dealing with autism in the way that we should be, which is to help the autistic people and their families who are already here.
My guest is Steve Silberman, author of the new book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Coming up later on, Dr. Jacqueline Nguyen, she's the director of the Center for Autism Spectrum Disorders at Nationwide Children's Hospital. She'll join the conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In the late 1990s, a sociologist named Judy Singer coined the term neurodiversity, the idea that neurological differences are the result of natural human variation rather than pathological disorders. The idea of neurodiversity provided a more nuanced approach to conditions such as autism, dyslexia, and ADD and ADHD. But the neurodiversity movement isn't universally accepted necessarily. Still with us is the author of Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity, Steve Silberman. And joining us in the studio is the director of the Center for Autism Spectrum Disorders at Nationwide Children's Hospital, Dr. Jacqueline Nguyen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
I wanted to start this segment with a discussion about how treatment for autism has changed over time and what even treatment means. And Steve Silberman, if you could kick it off for us from the historian's point of view, when did treatment versus isolation or nothing at all even start?
Well, you know, that was one of the fateful things about Connor's theory that he didn't talk about initially, but within a couple of years of publishing his landmark paper in 1943, he was blaming bad parenting for triggering autism in susceptible children. And that was, he was really under pressure from his colleagues who were psychoanalysts to do that, because they told him that if he posited autism as a genetic condition, that that would contribute to quote-unquote therapeutic hopelessness. So he ended up adopting the position that cold and unaffectionate parents were responsible for triggering the disorder in their children.
And in particular, and mothers.
Well, what's funny is that it was actually Bruno Bettelheim,
okay,
this guy who was sort of echoing Connor, who ended up becoming associated with the phrase refrigerator mothers. And yes, mothers certainly carried the burden of this. But that had a number of terrible effects. For one thing, Connor's recommended treatment for autism was institutionalization. Parents were told to put their child in an institution to, you know, even quietly remove their photographs from the family album and to not speak of them. So, you know, one thing that people, I'm old, I'm a, you know, an almost baby boomer. So a lot of my peers, you know, often say, how come I never heard of autism when I was young, you know? Well, one of the reasons is that the most profoundly affected children were in institutions. And they, it's not like there were luxurious autism wards in these, you know, state hospitals. They were often put on psych wards or in wards for adults with intellectual disability. They were very, very badly treated, as many people in these custodial care facilities were. They were subjected to experimental treatments like LSD and electroconvulsive shock, which may be partially effective for chronic depression, but not autism. So autistic people for two generations disappeared in institutions, and their families were told not to talk about them, and their families felt very isolated from one another because they were carrying this burden of shame that they had triggered this horrible condition in their children. And it was really terrible, and it was really parents who changed that view, actually, and organized and created associations of their own and began talking to each other and overturned the notion that they were responsible for their children's autism. So the beginnings of autism treatment are not good, but, you know, we've gotten better, and I'm very, very excited to hear from Jacqueline about the state of the art.
Right, Jacqueline, when you've been in the business of autism for a long time, over 20 years, you've seen a lot of changes, and then a lot that hasn't changed, too. Talk about, I mean, this was a several generations of people that went missing that were not even studied, let alone taken care of properly and treated properly. What do you make of that, and where did you play catch up from a clinician's point of view?
Well, I think there's been a lot of change over these. I think I've been in the field 27 years, so I've seen a lot of change, but it's been slow, but I think promising. So, you know, in the early 80s, there was a switch to, I think Steve's a better historian than I am, but, you know, looking back from a psychologist's perspective, that switch to thinking about problems that people faced from a more behavioral perspective to, really gave some hope to say, I think we can change these things. Let's look around in the environment. Let's figure out what these factors are. And we're not afraid to try and change something that could be neurologically based, genetically based. So there, you know, the work in ABA, behavioral interventions, to figure out what are the neurological factors that these kids are facing, how can we alter the way we interact with them, alter their environment, and make a world for them that better fits their neurological makeup. So it jibes, I think, a lot with, you know, Steve's perspective on our understanding of autism, because we needed to figure out how can we help. And there are strategies that that for kids who do have symptoms of autism that do affect their lives in a negative way, there are things we can do to help.
We like to think about what's causing it. If we can figure out what's causing it, then we can cure it. And that tends to be our, you know, as a society, our focus. Tell us about what your relationship is with a cure,
right?
When you talk about what you do.
It's interesting, in looking at Steve's book, I worked with Ivar Lovaas at UCLA for a long time. And, you know, his mantra was very much related to that, that there are people looking for a cure. That was just when I came in the 80s. That was just when NIMH was starting to fund more neurobiological research and genetic research. But, you know, his thought was that's for them. We have kids right in front of us right now that we need help and figure out how can we support the kids and the families.
They're not a lost cause.
Absolutely not. I mean, the whole basis of intervention these days for children with autism is the belief that if they are suffering from some symptom that is impacting their quality of life or their potential, that there's a way to assist and to either alter their environment, educate people. I mean, the education we have in the United States and across the world now about autism has really, I think, significantly impacted the potential for these kids, because we can put on society some of the burden. We can ask the society to alter the ways they're interacting with people on the autism spectrum to support their differences.
Jacqueline, do you mind if I ask you a question?
Yes.
I am fascinated by Lovaas. Can you recall any personal anecdotes where you really had an insight into his approach from something that he said or did? Because I think he's such an interesting person, actually.
Yeah, Ivar was fascinating. When I went to do graduate work with him, I worked with him kind of side by side for 13 years, and
wow,
even after that. And fascinating man, a man who was so totally dedicated to these children and their families, and so believed that there were ways that we could help and ways that we could really significantly change the developmental trajectory of kids who were really having impairments related to autism or cognitive impairment. And, you know, he was a guy without filter, a guy without limits, you know, a scientist who believed that if there was a grain of possibility in an idea, that it was worthwhile to pursue. And so some of his early work that's more controversial, I think, came out of that lack of self-filtering. It also was a lot of work kind of coming out of behavioral psychology, looking at, can we really change the most severe symptoms that kids with autism might display? And back then, like you were saying, Steve, these were kids that were very isolated, whose symptoms only got more and more severe in the conditions that they were in.
Right.
How do you suss out it
would have happened anyways from what was caused and forced upon them?
Right, exactly. So there were no educational supports. There was no support for families. You know, the kids were isolated. Lots of the early cases that were documented were about those most extreme circumstances where kids were very self-injurious. And so his trajectory was kind of born out of that early experience of kids that that didn't have much other support and were surrounded by experts, you know, and physicians and psychologists who'd had no idea what to do to help these kids in really dire circumstances. So there was really no idea of how to help change those things.
Steve Silberman, how did the trajectory of work on autism, how was it affected by the fact of this spectrum that we now recognize as a spectrum now, but wasn't always recognized that way?
Yeah, that in a way, that's almost the main theme of my book, was the discovery of the spectrum, or you could say the rediscovery of the spectrum. Because, as I say, Hans Asperger's team in Vienna had really discovered what they called the autistic continuum, but what we now call the autism spectrum, which is this very, very broad range of, you know, sort of diverse manifestations ranging from profoundly disabling things like extreme difficulty with language to sort of colorful eccentricities like talking a lot about chemistry or the weather. So Asperger, you know, you could say grokked that, if I can use a 60s word, in a way that Leo Kanner did not. Leo Kanner was very strongly resistant to the idea that autism was a spectrum, in part because he had a very different mission than Hans Asperger. Hans Asperger's mission was to help the kids in his clinic go on to succeed and, you know, find jobs and stay in school and, you know, make the best of whatever their condition was while expressing their maximum potential. Leo Kanner was busy launching child psychiatry in America. He was one of the first child psychiatrists in America. So what he was doing was he posited that autism was a very, very rare form of infantile psychosis. And in order to propose this new, you know, allegedly new condition, he had to define it very narrowly. So in a sense, the two men had completely different approaches. But I'm sorry, I forget what your original question was.
Just how the idea
Oh, the spectrum, yeah.
Well, yeah.
So what happened was, you know, what happened was for a couple of decades, the notion that autism was not a spectrum was kind of was prevailing in autism research. And in fact, it was considered so rare that not very many researchers got into it because it was just considered this really obscure disorder that you would never see in your career, so why bother, really? However, there was a woman in England named Lorna Wing, who was a cognitive psychologist who had a profoundly autistic daughter named Susie. Susie would have met the criteria for a diagnosis from Kanner, but because Lorna was hooked up with other parents in the early autism parents movement in the UK, she knew how families were struggling to find resources, and the families that were struggling most had kids who did not fit Kanner's strict criteria, and so were really, you know, left to twist slowly in the wind. These families with, you know, they're literally, the parents were told to let their children play in the garden with a ball. Like, that was supposed to be a, you know, that was the rest of their lives. You know, that was supposed to be a satisfying life, or at least the best that could happen. So what Lorna did was, with another researcher, she went out into a suburb of London called Camberwell to look for children who showed signs of autism. And what she found was that she found a wide variety of children who exhibited some manifestations of autism, but not necessarily so that they met Kanner's criteria for diagnosis. So she started to think that there was something wrong with Kanner's model, that it was too narrow and exclusive. And just then she literally stumbled over a reference to Asperger's paper, which had not yet been translated into English, believe it or not. And this was in the, you know, late 1970s, early 1980s. So Asperger's work was still virtually unknown in the English-speaking world. She had her husband, who spoke German, translated it. And when she read it, she said, "This is it. This is what I'm seeing." And she originally used the phrase autistic continuum, which I don't believe she heard it from Asperger's work, but that was just, it just happened to be, that was a synchronicity that both she and Asperger's team came up with that notion. But then she didn't like the word continuum because it sounded too dry. So she adopted the word spectrum because it reminded her of rainbows and other features of nature.
Dr. Nguyen, as far as treatment goes, for lack of a better word, just how you respond to someone who's been diagnosed on the spectrum, how has the fact that it is a spectrum, that it is a continuum, affected your field and how you approach responding and making the world the kind of place they need?
Well, certainly, I think, is a developing story. So, you know, even within our program in 2000, we began with early intensive interventions for young kids being diagnosed and kind of taking up the idea that early intervention can really help secure permanent, you know, changes in their neurological issues. But we soon found that there were many, many more areas of need in terms of treatment. And, you know, obviously we needed more supportive care for adolescents moving toward adulthood who still needed to learn some of the kind of more basic functional living skills and helping families figure out how they were going to make that jump, like you were saying earlier, from the support that a school system can provide to, you know, adulthood, which is a huge, huge hurdle that we still haven't fully supported. Then, you know, thinking about kids on the more extreme end of the spectrum with really severe problem behavior, what's out there for those children? There isn't a support network. So we, you know, started, you know, building assistance for those kids.
And likewise on the extreme abilities.
Yes. Yeah. And so for kids who are high functioning and, you know, kids who come to a center for treatment are kids who are experiencing some kind of distress and want some support. So there are probably plenty of children who are high functioning who have, you know, a diagnosis on an autism spectrum that aren't needing support. But for those higher functioning kids that that need that support, it tends to be about more comorbid mental health concerns. So issues of mood and depression, anxiety, some support for anger management and emotional regulation. Again, issues of socialization and transition into adulthood.
Is there a person like you at, you know, at regular hospitals? So you're director of the Center for Autism Spectrum Disorders at Nationwide Children's Hospital. It's something people live with their whole lives. Is it something that should be addressed across the span of life?
Oh, absolutely.
By people like you.
Yeah, and absolutely. And we're lucky in Columbus because there is, and even in Ohio, there's quite a lot of support and service within the hospitals within Ohio. And, you know, I've been lucky at Nationwide Children's because they've really allowed us to broaden the range of care we provide to really meet the needs of this huge spectrum of need, you know, this really broad range. And we've even in Central Ohio worked to figure out how we can transition that care into the adult medical and psychology service providers. But it isn't very common. It's, you know, here we are, you know, 2015, and we're still trying to take baby steps to figure out these kind of sociological shifts that we need to support this large number of people.
We're talking about autism, the legacy of autism, the history of autism, what we know about it, thanks to Steve Silberman on phone. He's the author of a new book called Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Also with us in the studio, Dr. Jacqueline Nguyen. She's the director of the Center for Autism Spectrum Disorders at Nationwide Children's Hospital. We'll continue. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. There's a lot we still don't know about what causes the factors that place somebody along the autism spectrum. Autism spectrum diagnoses often are described with words such as deficit, disorder, and impairment. But what if the distinctions are just a matter of difference, like light blue eyes versus dark blue eyes? Of course, there's a lot more at stake when we're talking about behavior. Still with us by phone is journalist and author Steve Silberman. He suggests that a lot of that disconnect stems from a series of historical aberrations. How the story of autism unfolds is told in his book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. And on our website, you can check that out at WOSU.org/allsides. Also still with us is the director of the Center for Autism Spectrum Disorders at Nationwide Children's Hospital, Dr. Jacqueline Nguyen. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I want to turn to a caller right now who has experience with a sibling. Marie in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Marie.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I know that one of the issues I've experienced is that my brother, who is on the spectrum, who is now 60 years old, 6-0, our mother tried to protect from all kinds of things. She kept saying to her friends, I know there's something wrong, but she never did anything to get help, even, you know, with some of his schoolwork. He's exceptionally bright, but he could never make the connections. And he struggled for a long time and became an alcoholic to self-medicate. He gratefully is in recovery, but I'm sharing this story because there are all kinds of issues now as an adult. Now that we have the diagnosis, our parents are dead, the siblings are trying to help, but he identifies that as his not being independent. And so it's very difficult to get him help now. And I'm sharing the story because I know there are parents who really don't want to deal with this kind of atypical behavior. I'm not saying abnormal. I'm saying it's simply just not typical. But what has happened in my brother's instance, he equates success the way the rest of us do, but he doesn't have the skill to get there. And it's devastating.
Because he has the intelligence to value it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So if there are parents who are thinking, no, you know, I think he'll grow out of it, I beg you, please, now that there is so much help available, please help your child by getting the resources that can help him or her or them have a sense of success and self-efficacy.
Well, Marie, thank you so much. It was stories like that about your brother is exactly what inspired my last comment to you, Jackie Nguyen, about, you know, the discipline seems to be at the childhood level when there are plenty of people that were misdiagnosed, not diagnosed, or ignored who are growing up in our society.
Yeah. And, you know, I think there is growing attention to that issue. So, you know, there are state task forces growing. In Ohio, we have a conglomerate of all the different agencies that support people in need and, you know, some of the vocational supports that adults would need to be able to move into the workplace and be successful are just starting to be attended to in view of autism. And so, you know, hopefully those systems can change to support better.
You know, when people say autism used to be so rare, Steve, you've pointed out how in the 1950s and 60s there was an epidemic of what was called childhood schizophrenia in state hospitals and special schools. And that if you took a look at a description of childhood schizophrenia, it closely resembles autism.
Yes, so closely that, in fact, the criteria for childhood schizophrenia were incorporated wholesale eventually into autism. And whereas childhood schizophrenia was considered, as you say, you know, so common that it was like an epidemic in the 1950s and 60s, it's now considered very rare. So where did all those people go?
Right.
Well, they went into the category of autism. But I just want to say to Marie, the caller, that was an incredibly eloquent statement. And unfortunately, it's a story that I've heard over and over about older autistic adults who really, you know, were not able to get a diagnosis because the diagnosis was not broad enough to apply to adults, sort of, you know, tried to endure life never knowing why they weren't succeeding in their employment, why they weren't succeeding in their relationships, why they felt estranged from everyone around them. I've heard that so many times. And I just, at the publication party for my book the other night here in San Francisco, an autistic woman stood up and said that getting a diagnosis for her was like, quote unquote, finding the Rosetta Stone to myself. And to anyone who has a relative or who themselves think that perhaps they're on the spectrum, there's a book called I Think I Might Be Autistic by an autistic woman named Cynthia Kim that is an excellent sort of introduction to thinking about getting a diagnosis. So I definitely recommend it.
I was watching a video, a Google talk online the other day, and by the girl who wrote Diary. I can't remember it now. I feel badly. But she wrote a book about growing up with autism. She's only, by the way, 18 years old. She wrote it when she was 15 years old.
Wow.
And she remembered the moment when she was watching television and someone was describing something about autism. And she went to her mom and said, "Do I have autism?" She's obviously super high functioning, but struggled with a lot of those kinds of things. Dr. Nguyen, do we know about how many people, when they deinstitutionalize a lot of mental institutions, and how many people were let go who are on the spectrum?
Oh, gosh, I wouldn't know the numbers, but, you know, I think a considerable, you know, number of those individuals who needed that kind of, you know, ongoing residential support.
At least protection.
Yeah, were on the spectrum. And, you know, hopefully the idea of moving into the community, you know, all these great, they are excellent ideas of helping incorporate people with differences into our community, of having apartments and, you know, even moving away from group homes to have apartment-based living, but with the supports that you require. I mean, these are the directions we're trying to go in. There just needs to be probably a lot more of it to really meet
the
need.
And can I point something out? You mentioned, Jacqueline, that there were more services for adults now in Ohio, which is wonderful to hear. I actually went to Oberlin, by the way.
Oh, great.
But the sad truth is that in June, the Government Accountability Office reported that the investment from the National Institutes of Health into research on improving the lives of autistic adults had actually gone down in recent years. And, you know, I think that that's one area where we as a society think that we're dealing with autism by doing these sort of endless fishing expeditions for quote-unquote risk factors and candidate genes. You know, is that interesting science? Of course, yes, it is. I have lots of friends who are involved in autism science. But we certainly need more research on things like the comorbidities you mentioned and epileptic seizures and, you know, basically how to help autistic people lead healthier lives. And we really need more research on the lives of autistic adults, because autistic adults with, you know, a couple of exceptions like Temple Grandin are still virtually invisible in our society and struggling.
How much of all of that was became a distraction in the tidal wave of interest about whether or not vaccinations were causing autism, Steve Silberman?
Well, yes. You know, the question of vaccinations sort of diverted a lot of the energy of the parents' movement, which was originally intended to, with a very bold purpose, to change the world to become a better place for autistic people and their families. And back then, you know, many autistic people were nonverbal, so parents really had to do the talking and the fighting and the advocating, and they bravely did. But then the energy of some of the parents' movement got diverted into these angry arguments about whether or not vaccines cause autism. And so I think that we're, you know, starting to recover from that, as we notice, for instance, that if you don't give children vaccines, then you get resurgences of childhood diseases like measles and mumps, like the big so-called Disneyland measles outbreak earlier this year. But also, you know, the thing is that families long after they've, you know, accepted the fact that their child has autism, whether or not they believe it was caused by a vaccine or not, they have to figure out a way for their children to live happy lives and independent lives, or at least to live lives that are, you know, that don't make parents afraid to die and leaving their children alone in the world. And so much of that work and the study of autism in even teenagerhood and maturity is yet to be done. It's in front of us. And so, you know, should we really be sending another $50 million to the Beijing Genomics Institute to find more candidate genes? You know, it's a question that I think we need to start asking.
Dr. Nguyen, talk about the parents' movement. With so many, again, for lack of a better quick word, disabilities, the greatest advocates, the vanguard of advocacy comes from parents. What is your experience with parents and where their energy is directed at this point?
Yeah, I have, I think, kind of a long history helping or working with families, you know, who are in the forefront of making, you know, sociological government level change, you know. So out in California, the system to care for kids with autism, the educational strategies, the funding models, the huge amount of changes that happened in the 90s in that state were all because of parent effort, despite all the professionals and researchers that were there in the state. And that was mirrored here in Ohio, too. There was a group in the 90s and early 2000s that were instrumental in having our center begin, and were a network for each other in terms of educating new families that were just getting a diagnosis to understand what steps to take and, you know, what rights they had within the educational system. So my experience is that the families in this world who have a child on the spectrum are, one, amazing in the work they do within their own family, but two, have a commitment to support the community as a whole and have really paved the way, I think. You know, Autism Speaks, which is a national entity, was, I think, born out of, you know, some powers that be, but also some personal connections and family members that were committed to making change. And that organization has done quite a bit to help raise the awareness about autism and make change.
We're running out of time, Steve Silberman, but I can't let you go before we talk a little bit about how Asperger saw autistic people as a subset of humanity that had accelerated the evolution of science and technology. And, of course, when you think about how many people, particularly during the Holocaust, were put to death that fell into that category, probably the people that were institutionalized over the 50s and 60s, what we've lost, if that is the case. What do you think about that concept? It's sort of kind of almost science fiction-y sounding.
Well, yeah. One of my favorite anecdotes about Asperger was that in one of his original pieces of writing, he was talking about the children in his clinic were fascinated with rocket ships, and probably because of the word autism, as it was originally meant by the schizophrenia expert Eugen Bleuler, Asperger said, "Oh, yes. Yeah, so now with this obsession with rocket ships, we can see how remote from reality the fascinations of autistic children are." Anyway, he ended up changing his mind about that once rocket ships became, you know, the subject of daily news. So he was really the first person to notice that, you know, I'm not saying every autistic person,
right,
because nothing is true of every autistic person, but many, many autistic people are fascinated with science, technology, science fiction in particular, you know, Star Trek, etc. And what Asperger eventually came to accept was that autistic people, their interests often tended to cluster around the invention of the future. Mm-hmm. And I argue in my book that, in fact, several autistic people were involved in, you know, the creation of what we now call the internet. But yeah, so.
Okay. Well, you know. I could go on for a very long time. Steve Silberman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Steve Silberman, he's author of the new book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. And Dr. Jacqueline Wynn, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Jacqueline Wynn, she's director of the Center for Autism Spectrum Disorders at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Shyla Knott, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thank you so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.